Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast. In this episode, we ask the question, should you water cool your PC? We look at the Gigabyte Z170X SoC Force, and I post my first video on YouTube. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today, I have Darren McKinney. Darren, when I'm at the various trade shows like CES and Computex, I'm often asked if I have a YouTube channel.
I thought we did have a YouTube channel.
Oh, we do. We have one at Hardware Asylum, and there was also one at Ninja Lane, but there isn't really anything on there. And my response to them is often, you know, I have a face for radio, so, you know, I don't do videos.
But you have done some video, at least in the past.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I have a video for the Mystic Lights on the X99 Godlike from MSI, and a couple of other little videos, like I did one with overclocking to pouring liquid nitrogen in and showing how you torch the pot and stuff like that.
Well, I know you've also done some guest spots on some other streams and podcasts, but what makes you think you need to do YouTube?
Well, there's the millennials, I should say, you know, the youngsters that are now, you know, too lazy to read, so they just watch a video about something. Well, the manufacturers are targeting these people because, you know, that's the up-and-coming crowd. And they find that the YouTube channels are very popular. Personally, I don't think it's a very good format to convey a motherboard review or a video card review. It's just kind of a very condensed version showing some pictures of it and saying, well, it's faster than this, it's faster than that. But there's no setting up the system. There's no background into the testing or how you tested or if you tested. It's just more or less a 30-minute long marketing spiel done by one person that happens to have a lot of experience with Adobe Premiere or one of those video editors. But I've gone out and checked some of these channels, I should say. You know, there's a lot of popular ones like Tech Syndicate and Jay's Two Cents and Paul's Hardware, and they've all had starts with other companies. For instance, Paul's Hardware, he was at Newegg TV. That's kind of how he got his following. And then he broke off because he didn't like to be constrained, right?
Right.
So I decided to experiment a little bit with YouTubing. You know, I've tried to do a stream where we stream like the podcast, for instance, and then it would go to Twitch and then I could transfer it to YouTube. I don't have a lot of bandwidth for that. You know, DSL here in Idaho is pretty crappy. So I resorted to just doing a video, and I was experimenting with taking episode 60 of the podcast, creating a nice little picture banner of our logo saying, hey, Hardware Asylum Podcast, the number one podcast for hardware enthusiasts. Put that up there and then set audio to it, render out a video, and then upload that to YouTube.
That all sounds good.
It all sounds good, yes. 30 minutes of video at 1080p, that's a lot of data. I mean, the first couple of times I rendered this out, it was 9 gigs.
And that's just audio with a static image?
Yeah, audio with a static image. Somewhere along the lines, I was bloating the video. So I started playing around with different compression algorithms and different ways of compressing the audio and different keyframes for, you know, the picture. It's still rendering at 30 frames a second, but if you can use the same keyframe, then it doesn't have to multiply it or something like that. It can copy it across as part of the compression, I guess.
Sure. Very technical somehow.
Very technical, yes. Ultimately, I was able to render it down, got it down to 270 megs.
Okay. That's a big compression.
Big compression down from 9 gigs. I was able to upload that. It took 44 minutes. It also took 44 minutes to export. So my Ivy Ridge E was really chugging along at 100% rendering out all these frames, but I was able to compress it down, get it small, upload it. It took as long to upload as it did to render, but now it's on YouTube.
So we have episode 60 live on YouTube right now.
Live on YouTube at 1080p. So it's got some really good visuals. They don't move. So it's a lot like going to hardwareasylum.com, going to the podcast section and clicking play, except now it's on YouTube.
All right. How did it go? Pretty good, it sounds like. Just slow?
Yeah, just slow. I mean, 2 hours start to finish, basically. I don't know if I want to go through all 92 episodes, as of this recording, of the podcast and then push those out to YouTube. But I would like to get some feedback from our listeners who might actually go out there and check it out. Do you like that format? Would you rather it really be an MP3 that you can download and put on your mobile device or go to the website and play? Or should there be moving pictures with the one that's on YouTube? Obviously, that's going to be yes, but, you know.
Little bite-sized reviews like everyone else is doing, maybe.
Yeah, or maybe like just some flashing around, like show a motherboard and show some pictures and show a, you know, do a Fight Club thing. I don't know.
Well, we'll have to figure it out. So we'd love to have you guys check out our YouTube channel, Fledgling YouTube channel, and let us know what you think and what you'd like to see us do out there in the future. So give us some direction and give us that feedback via the forum.
Like and subscribe.
Recently, Dennis, you wrote an article, I think as a response to a YouTube, which is interesting that we've just talked about that, about water cooling. Specifically, do I need to water cool my PC?
That's a very good question. And yes, I did write that article.
Yeah, and it's a good read. So I'd encourage you to check that out. Maybe pause now and go check it out. But if you don't, that's okay. I have a fairly recent build of my computers. I'm sure many of our listeners are aware. And it's not water-cooled. In fact, this is the first machine that I've had in a while that doesn't have a self-contained water-cooling loop in it. In fact, it has a Noctua cooler.
Yep, and we did that on purpose.
We did, and part of the reason for that was to keep the cost down, but also part of that was to give us some flexibility in case we got a new cooler or a water-cooling kit. So, I have to admit, I was a little nervous about water-cooling.
And why is that?
Well, you know, I read your article, and it got me thinking about it, but my last experiences with water cooling are I don't know, it's been maybe 10 years since I tried to build a water cooling PC. And I'm just trying to think of what the build was, and I think it might have been a Core 2 Duo, but it could have been even older than that. But I built a water cooling block, and I pieced it together from several different sites at the time, and I could not get it to stop leaking.
That is a very common problem with water cooling, especially the ones that we did 10 years ago, because it was all soft tubing, flexible tubing, and hose clamps. There wasn't really a good place or way to get compression style fittings at the time.
So I spent a lot of money, Dennis, in those days on what I thought were premium pieces, parts and barbs and kits and, you know, learn to speak the language. And I ended up where, well, part of the problem is that, you know, I move my PC more than the average person because I like to go to LAN parties or drag it to the lab or whatever. But I ended up having to keep a wad of, you know, like a Blue Auto paper towels on top of my video card to prevent it from getting ruined. And I tried the different liquids that supposedly won't hurt your PC or whatever, but I just couldn't keep it from leaking. So I walked away. And in fact, I walked away from water cooling for a long time, and it wasn't until Coolit came out with some pretty nice self-contained units that I even tried an all-in-one kit because I was so afraid it was going to hurt my components.
Yeah, that Coolit kit, that was the one with the Peltiers, and I'm trying to remember the name right now, but it was basically an all-in-one unit, and instead of a radiator, it had kind of a radiator, but they were all flanked with Peltiers.
Yeah, the Eliminator, I think, is the one you're thinking of. So picture, if you will, a radiator that's barreled with, I think it had four different Peltiers around the side of it that leached the heat right off of it. And it was very, very efficient, but also very expensive. And the company didn't put out upgrades for it, so I think I still have it sitting on a shelf because I spent so much money on it that I just, you know, wanted to find a way to make it work again and just never did.
Also, since then, CPUs have gotten a lot more powerful, and they put out a lot more heat to the point where those Peltiers wouldn't have been able to keep up. Back in the Core 2 Duo days and before, you know, the CPU put out maybe 40 watts of heat, so you could dissipate that with a Peltier without having a second power supply in there.
Well, and I should point out that despite the fact that the Coolit system worked really well, it wasn't exactly a simple system. I mean, there was a lot there that could go wrong. And it worked well, and it cooled well, but I was always very nervous that something was going to fail. The Peltiers would go out, and I would lose my system.
Yeah, that's a real danger.
So anyway, I walked away. I've had the Sidon all-in-ones fairly recently in my system, and we've used the Corsair units. And the reality is that all those kits are kind of interchangeable. So when you started talking water cooling again, I thought, well, maybe now we're in the days of hard lines and things are mature enough that it's time to take the plunge.
All right.
Now, I should point out that it's still a very expensive and very scary step.
Well, yeah, I mean, you are putting water inside your PC, and everyone in the world says, do not mix water with your electrical components because reasons.
Yeah, not good. But the technology, I think, is advanced enough in the last 10 years that I really feel like it's got to be better.
You know, the leaking problems that you were talking about, that could have been anything, either like the hose clamps you used or the type of tubing that you was on there, or maybe even the hose clamp was too wide. I'm not sure. I never saw it.
You know, it's been so long, I couldn't even tell you. I just know it was a constant hassle.
Yeah. Well, and in the article that will be linked down in the show notes, I showed a couple of pictures of a water-chilled loop where I hooked a water block up to an AMD processor and then ran, instead of going to a radiator, I ran it to my single-stage phase cooler and basically brought the temperature down to -2 going directly. Well, that was at the reservoir, so that was after it had already gone to the CPU and came back.
See, and all that sounds really good. And I have to admit, I'm also intrigued by quieting the system down a little bit. And I have a pretty quiet system.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's time, I think. So anyway, your article got me scratching that itch a little bit. We got together a little bit and we had, as a catalyst, I should point out, the fancy new ThermalTake announcement for their ttpremium.com.
Mm-hmm. ttpremium.com is basically a nice web outlet to where you can buy all of their premium water cooling gear now. This is a recent development over the past 2 or 3 years where they've started focusing a lot on the hardware PC enthusiast, namely with the water cooling movement, the sub-movement that's kind of coming back because we had, you know, old school water cooling, which is something we can dive back into and something that Darren talked about, to the all-in-one revolution, which was, it kind of got away from DIY water cooling because it was a self-contained unit, easy, no maintenance involved, and relatively inexpensive.
Yeah, I mean, price point, you could get a really nice self-contained unit for about the same as a premium air-cooled system. And that's what got me interested in those in the first place.
Yeah. Well, and as I mentioned in the article, the Europeans really kind of took over the water cooling hobby, I should say. They brought in aftermarket support, mostly with EK. They started to be able to produce blocks for specific motherboards where you could water cool the VRM and also the chipset. They had a variety of different CPU blocks that would match the larger LGA 2011 processors, namely the smaller ones, on LGA 115X. And then also full coverage video card blocks, which is really the one thing that the defining moment between when water cooling becomes a not so much a hobby to something that somebody needs to have a whole lot of money to be able to invest.
I have a Haswell E system that we've talked quite a bit about, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I'm still running a single 970 with, you know, occasional thoughts of adding a second video card, you know, as the prices have come down on that. And we wanted to sit down and see if we could use the TT Premium site to put together a solid system that wouldn't be too terribly budget-destroying, because we've talked so much in the past about how difficult it is to get water cooling parts here in the States. So I'm going to let Dennis talk a little bit about the build and some of the pros and cons that we've come up with. And I want to point out that, of course, this is subject to change as we're trying to fine-tune it and work on the budget. But Dennis, tell us what we're thinking about putting together.
Okay. So in terms of water cooling, there's a couple of ways that you can look at it. The first one is we want to water cool the entire system, and that's where you get these multi-video card blocks and crazy dual loops and, you know, the really fancy systems you see passed around on Twitter every once in a while. But those price prohibitive. So we're going to go basic loop. So we're just going to cool the CPU, in which case we need CPU block. And then we're going to go with a 280 radiator, which is a dual 140 millimeter fan, so that way we can get more airflow through there, keep the fan speed down, but we also have a lot of heat capacity because there's a lot of volume there.
I should point out at this point that if you haven't checked out the custom build articles, Now, what we're talking about is the V51 case, which is a very open case build, which gives us a lot of options for water cooling. We have lots of space to work with, but the side effect of that also is you want that space to be not only functional, but to look good as well.
Right. Well, we have a big window that's going to show off all this stuff. And that Core V51 is a liquid-cooled certified case from Thermaltake, and that was one of the first cases that came out during their transition to support water cooling and enthusiast PCs and stuff. So it's a very good case for this particular build. Along with the radiator, we're going to need coolant, obviously. Thermaltake, for some reason, doesn't recommend using distilled water, which was a mainstay back in the day, and I'm assuming that has to do with contaminants in the radiator or something. As we know, distilled water likes to absorb anything that's near. We're going to go with a 200 milliliter reservoir, and we do that mostly to match the size of the liquid to the size of the radiator, and that's mostly to even out the system so that we have good heat capacity and enough extra liquid so that the radiator can cool what's in the loop and get us the best temperatures.
Okay, so why not go bigger? I know the case will support a larger radiator, and certainly we have room for a reservoir.
Well, we could definitely go with more reservoir space. If we do two of them, for instance, we risk having not enough space for everything else.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to start with 200 milliliters, and we'll have just basically one reservoir, and we might add the pump to the bottom of it to kind of keep it compact. That's going to match well for our single CPU coolant.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, we're not cooling as many items as some of these builds.
Yep. Now, if you happen to get a block for your video card, we can add that to the loop. Then we might add another reservoir so that we have more liquid. It'll just depend on how the layout of the case happens. So right now, just one reservoir. We're going to have a pump either connected to it or separate. We're going to do compression fittings because we're going to hardline hard acrylic tube or PET tubing. And back in the early days, we had soft tubing. It was silicone-based.
Yeah, I'm basically glorified fish tank tubing.
Yeah, pretty much. That was a real challenge to get the tube runs, one, the right length, but then also get them routed in your case so that they weren't laying over top of something. They didn't have any weird kinks in them. Well, with hardline tubing, we can bend it exactly to our specifications. So if we want to have the tube come directly off the CPU block straight up and then horizontally across the case and then drop down to the bottom of the reservoir, we can do that without having any kinks, without any like U-bends that might slow down the flow and stuff like that.
Well, that sounds a little bit complicated. How do you do that with the hard line?
You use basically a torch or a heat gun. And then just like if you're going to bend copper tubing, you have to have a mandrel to bend it on so that you don't kink one end of it. But you have a solid piece of silicone that goes in the tubing to make sure that it doesn't collapse.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. It's pretty fancy. You basically put it over the heat gun, twist it around a few times until it gets soft, and then slowly bend it. You can bend it on the mandrel or you can do it by hand. That's something that we will explore when we finally install it, and we'll do a couple of pictures and maybe a YouTube video. I'm not sure.
Maybe.
We're going to probably get the bending kit from Thermaltake because they have one that has the deburring tool. So when you cut the PET tubing, there's always some burrs in there. So it has a little knife to get that out of there. Otherwise, we'd have to use sandpaper or like a hobby knife or something. And then we might have to go buy some new ring fans so that we can cool everything and make everything look good.
Well, very nice. I'm looking forward to it. So I'm a little curious, though. What do some of these pieces parts cost? I know the big cost is the CPU block, right?
It used to be CPU block was the most expensive piece. These days, it depends on the size of your radiator for the most part. CPU blocks have kind of, they've equalized on price. Everybody has a different one, obviously. We could go to ttpremium.com. I think they're like $150 for a CPU block.
Oh, so that's a serious investment.
Well, you only buy one for the most part, right? The radiator, if we went with one that was about an inch thick, for instance, that's obviously going to be more than if we do like a 120 millimeter that's only 25 millimeters thick. The benefit of the small radiator is that, you know, it's easy, small, but it doesn't have a lot of heat capacity. If you go with the big, super thick radiator, there's more liquid in there. There's more potential for heat capacity, basically, but we have a lot of material to push air through. So we need dual-sided fans, and they have to be pretty high pressure to be able to push air through there.
That makes sense to me. So we're talking about a fairly expandable system. Gives us some future-proofing, which is very nice. When you spend that much money, you want to be able to hopefully keep your system around for a while.
Well, yeah, definitely. With the Core V51, we have the option to put, we could do a triple fan radiator. We could also put radiator in the front. So if we wanted to add a second loop, for instance, you know, a loop for your CPU and then a loop for a video card, then we could have the radiator in the front, maybe controlling the video card or cooling the video card, and then the radiator in the top doing the CPU. And those can be basically installed separately at separate times. Or if we just basically add a video card to it, we just unhook one tube, rebend it, and then loop it in.
So we haven't talked a little bit about other components that might be water-cooled. I mean, we talked a little bit about the video card, but I know that you can water-cool also parts of your motherboard, and I've seen motherboards that are built with water-cooling in mind, although I admit they're pretty rare.
They are. One of the first ones I remember was the Foxconn Black Ops. This was a LGA 775 X48 based motherboard that had, it was designed for overclocking basically, and one of the key components you want to keep cool is the chipset on the motherboard. They had a water block included with the kit that you could install, or there was an evaporator so you could pour liquid nitrogen in there. After that, there was the Blood Rage came with an actual chipset block similar to the Black Ops. You could run water through that. You couldn't take it apart though, and that was the biggest downside to both of those, is that they were completely soldered together, very difficult to clean, and the one time I used it, I tried to get all the water out, but it corroded in a couple of months afterwards, so it was terrible. And companies still do that. For instance, Gigabyte has offered a water-cooled VRM on their SoC motherboards all the way back to like Z87 days, but those were added cost to the motherboard, and they were self-contained units to the point where you couldn't clean them. So it didn't really get any better. And of course, if you go with an aftermarket with EK where it has a full coverage block, you might be able to clean them, but you have to buy a very specific motherboard to be able to use that.
That sounds very limiting and also more expensive. So why is that, why we didn't go that route?
Yeah, we didn't go that route. Mostly, we didn't need it, for one. The X99, the VRM does get warm, but we have plenty of case cooling or case fans in your particular case to be able to keep everything cool. The chipset doesn't get very hot at all, and it has a very large heatsink on it already, you know, because it's designed to be underneath video cards, so it's going to stay cool. And a lot of it was the cost. I mean, we could get a block for it, but it would be very specific to either just the VRM or generic one that might go over the chipset, but that's a lot of extra cost, and you may not need it.
Well, and that sort of shoots our future-proofing expandability argument out the window. If it's not something we need, then I certainly don't like to pay for it, that's for sure.
Well, no. And it, by doing a build this way, it proves that you can do DIY water cooling on somewhat of a budget. You don't necessarily have to spend $2,000 or $6,000 on all your water cooling supplies just to have it be a maintenance nightmare 3 months down the road when your coolant changes color, or if you need to add something to the loop, or hey, if you have a leak in between video cards or something like that.
Yeah, we definitely don't want to have leaks, that's for sure. And I think part of that is doing your homework up front, making sure that you have quality components. But I think some of it also is just the maturation of the market. And that's what, again, has got me looking forward to it. So to loop back to your article a little bit, do we really need to water cool my PC?
Well, yes. And I say that as a PC enthusiast. From a pure keeping your system cool standpoint, no, you probably don't need to. But we are enthusiasts. We want to get the best performance. And in your particular instance, we want it to be quiet.
Yes, we do.
And with water cooling, the biggest advantage these days to water cooling is the fact that it is extremely quiet. The pumps make hardly any noise. If you run your tubes correctly, you won't have any cascading water noises in there, unless you want to have like some white noise in the background or something.
No. Enough of that already.
Yeah. And then with the radiators, we're going with a 280 in your particular build, mostly for surface area. So we can run 140 millimeter fans on there and then turn them down so they don't have to spin very fast. So the only noise that you will have in your system will be from the video card fans. And, you know, if you're playing Battlefield, it's going to ramp up those a little bit.
Sure, that's expected.
And you're going to have a little bit of noise from your power supply, but you're running the Cooler Master still, and you can dial that down as much as you want.
Yeah, with the hybrid power supply, I'm looking forward to very little fan. So at this point, I think if everything goes as planned, I'll really only be at the mercy of the video card, and that is something that we can tackle in another phase.
Yeah, exactly. Darren, a couple of weeks ago, I posted something on the Hardware Asylum Facebook page about how a motherboard has curb appeal.
Okay.
And it garnered a little bit of attention from the manufacturer and also from some of the people that follow the Hardware Asylum Facebook page.
It's not the kind of description you usually hear when we talk about motherboards.
Well, no, but the Gigabyte Z170X SoC Force, I think, is the epitome of what curb appeal could be for a motherboard. And I want to say that it's not necessarily like the stuff they put on the board, but the appearance of the motherboard when you pull it out of the box.
It's definitely an attractive motherboard.
Yeah. Well, and we have it here on the table, which, you know, we're going to do another pseudo unboxing over the radio waves of podcastness.
Dun, dun, dun.
I guess Darren can grab it and he can quiz me on certain things and we'll just try to go through what we got.
Well, the first thing that jumps out at me, this being a fairly overclocked and water cooling themed podcast, is these little screw-on doodads for, it looks like, an overclocking style water-cooled VRM setup.
Yes, that's a very interesting way to describe it, but we do have a water-cooled VRM. So the heatsink that's on here is basically a big chunk of aluminum with a couple of heat pipes going through it, but then they allowed you a path for water. So you got some G-quarter threads, and that's the little doodads that you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
On both sides. So we have water in, water out. Unfortunately, this, like I talked about in the previous segment, it's a kind of a self-contained cooler. There's really not any way to clean it. And I'm not sure if inside it was, if it was like chromed or nickel plated, or if it's just kind of raw copper. So who knows what's in there, but if you want to integrate that with your DIY loop that you're going to run on this motherboard, you can water cool the VRM quite easily.
I should also point out that I don't see a heat pipe connecting it to the chipset, so it's a separate unit.
Mm-hmm. Very separate. Yeah, the chipset on the Skylake Z170X, it doesn't get hot. Doesn't really need a heatsink.
Well, and it's got a pretty good size one on here.
Well, it does, and that's mostly because there's supposed to be four video cards on here, and it's going to cover the whole thing. So.
Well, that's true, too. Now, it is a very attractive motherboard, also from the color scheme, which is almost an orange red with orange accents on black.
Well, the OC boards from Gigabyte all use the orange color theme, so I really like how that goes. Part of the curb appeal is the fact that the graphics are very definitive and very well placed. Like on the chipset, for instance, we have the OC logo and then Gigabyte underneath it. But then the cuts in the aluminum, very ornate, and they kind of flank the logos. Like, they put the cuts in there after they put the logo on, which was kind of cool. We have some shielding over there across the I.O. that has SoC Force across the top of it.
Yeah, and that really cleans that up, because that's an area that traditionally looks a little bit sketchy, but it, you know, you're plugging a lot of stuff into these motherboards.
I say I.O., but that was actually for the SATA connections and stuff like that.
No, I was following you.
Yeah,
the
actual
is true of the I.O.
Yeah, the actual I.O. has a shield over it. It says Super Overclock, which is what the SoC stands for. This is a very common thing. I mean, EVGA kind of started doing it with an add-on cover that you can kind of screw in when you installed your motherboard. ASUS started to add them after that. MSI has now added them. So it's kind of a very common thing. But it really cleans up the installation of your system.
Now, this has got a pretty impressive I.O. block here, and I think I see the new USB 3.0 standard.
Yeah, the Type-C.
Type-C. I've drawn to the reset button here, I think is what that is.
I believe so, yes.
And it's interesting that they have a dual color on the PS port there. So
yeah, well, when you are doing CPU-based overclocking, you don't want to have anything plugged into the USB ports because it takes CPU cycles away. So if you plug into the standard PS2 port, you don't have any of that CPU overhead. So add you another half a millisecond or whatever.
Time. Hey, every little bit when you're talking competitive here. I also see the OC touch panel.
Oh yeah, they dressed that up really, really nice. There's a lot of buttons on there too.
Well, there's a lot of buttons around it also in switches here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of those change like the BIOS, what BIOS you're going to boot into. One's a reset, one's clear CMOS and then clear memory. So if you're doing memory overclocking, you can clear the memory but not clear the CMOS.
Nice.
And then some of the other ones, honestly, I have to look in the manual to know exactly what they do. But the OC Touch panel has been kind of a staple on just about every OC board that's come out of Gigabyte. This is the first one that has it on an actual panel. I mean, there's actually a box and the buttons are fit in there and there's the buttons click now sometimes.
Oh, nice.
Some are momentary.
Oh,
and some
toggles, yeah.
Some actually toggle. Ever since the inception of this OC Touch, you've had to install a driver in Windows to be able to use it. But it allows you access to overclock different aspects of the chipset and the CPU from Windows using that tool. So it's a nice bench overclocking little button thing.
Now, we've talked in the past about the high-end overclocking boards sometimes being very bare bones as far as the feature set. And I see on here we have, you know, really everything I would expect from a high-end motherboard, even the amped-up audio with its separate shielding here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and that whole area lights up very, very bright orange. There's a, right by the shielding, there's an OC logo in the motherboard that has the pass-through.
Very cool. I also see that this is at least the first board that I've handled that has three M.2 slots, the 32 GBS slots.
Yeah, that's a product of more PCI Express on the chipset.
Nice. I know that that's kind of where the future is headed with drives these days, which is nice. Very self-contained on the motherboard.
Well, you have that extra PCI Express. You might as well use it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you know, that helps as we start looking at the general shrink that we're seeing in the market, too. They're smaller and more efficient.
Mm-hmm. And faster. We also have the metal shielding on the PCI Express slots, which are really more of a reinforcement than a shield. If you turn the board over, they are soldered directly to the board on the back side. I've only had one PCI Express slot slide off of a motherboard in my entire many, many years of using boards. And admittedly, I had to try to pull it off there. But I can imagine if you are shipping a complete system and have it locked down with the PCI Express lock here and the case breaks, there's a chance that a heavy video card is going to pull that slot off there. So,
well, especially with some of the size that we're seeing in, you know, the AMD, for example, with the oversized heat sinks. Well, it's very nice. I see we've got four video card slots and they're nicely spaced, as you've already mentioned. Have you had a chance to do any testing on this board?
I've started preliminary testing on this board, as of this podcast, by the way. I have no doubt that I'll be able to put four video cards in there, although it'll probably be limited to four-way crossfire and only two-way SLI due to the PCI Express lane requirements of doing SLI.
Very nice. Now, of course, DDR4 on here, and I see you've got some Corsair Vengeance on there, which looks really good with the board.
Yeah, it's red. It goes well with the orange, so that's nice. In terms of power, we have an 8-pin and a 4-pin up here next to the CPU socket. And if you look underneath the heatsink, it's very well hidden. There is a ton of power phases going to the CPU.
There were so many, I wouldn't have guessed that's what that was. It looks like just part of the heatsink.
That's one thing I really like about this board. It's very well thought out from a design standpoint. They got shielding in the right spot. They don't have gaudy shielding that just kind of covers everything. Heat sinks are very well cut. I mean, we have a nice beveled edge on the VRM cooler, so we have some good airflow around the CPU section. IO shield, we already talked about. The other shielding, we have an actual shield that goes over top of the audio. And then, of course, our Intel chip for our NIC, and then also another clock generator for the base clock. One of the other items that I really liked was we got PCI Express disable switches.
Oh, that's what that is.
Yeah, that's what those got. Right next to the debug LED, which every high-end overclocking board needs to have a debug LED.
Well, two USB 3.0 channels right on the board too, which is a nice plus.
We also have SATA Express, which I thought would really be going away with the advent of M.2. You know, it's reverse compatibility for people that might have bought one of those devices, I guess.
Well, and for your opticals and that sort of thing, it's still a little early to be phasing those out, although don't tell Microsoft.
Well, no, of course not. there's also a couple of USB ports next to the SATA connections.
Oh, I see that.
And that was a standard from a long time ago. HiCookie likes to have easy access to the USB when he's overclocking. And you always have the I.O. facing away from you. That way the cables are out of your way.
Makes sense.
So it's kind of, you know, at that point, it gets a little cumbersome to reach behind there to put a thumbstick in.
Well, and speaking of cooling, I see a lot of locations for fans and system fans, which is sometimes a hassle with today's modern cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be one of my, you know, pseudo complaints is that to get to a fan header, like for instance, the one over here by the VRM cooler, there's one between it and the IO shield. That is very, very difficult to get to with my fat fingers.
Well, hopefully you only have to do it once. But I can see, especially from the attractive look of this, that there was a lot of attention given to this being an open bench board as opposed to being in a system belt. Although I have to admit, I think it would look great in a window case.
Oh, yeah. You put your DIY water cooling on here. You route your hoses the right way. The heat sinks, you don't have to touch them. I mean, they look perfect. And if you want to water cool it, you put into your G quarter threads hose barbs up there and away you go.
So I have to ask, is this a look that we're seeing across Gigabyte, or is this confined specifically to these super overclock boards?
It is a design look that is going to go across the entire realm, at least of the Skylake boards. At Computex this last year, they showed me a couple of the pre-release for the G1 gaming boards, and it contained the same shielding, the same VRM cooler, except instead of black and orange, they were white and red.
Yeah, I've always been a huge fan of the G1 boards, so it's nice to hear that they're getting the same attention.
Yeah, well, I want to say it started there and it's kind of trickling down. Preferably, you know, I like black. I like black and red, black and orange. I wasn't really a fan of the white and red, but that's really personal preference. And, you know, you think about it, there's a lot of pure white cases that you can buy, so that makes a perfect match.
Well, that's been something we've seen an increase that in the light blues as well. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what this thing can do. So, future plans?
Future plans, I am going to do the normal testing on air, and then I'm going to bring this out to the lab and put it on the phase change.
Very nice.
So I'm going to be doing some overclocking sub-ambient.
Something to look forward to, guys. So check back with us and definitely check out the pictures of this super sexy SoC Force motherboard in the forums and on our website at hardwareasylum.com.
For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes on hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS. Follow us on Google or like us on Facebook. This has been an Engine Lane production, copyright 2016. Thanks for listening.